Hello, this is Lois Walsh, reading the Vermilion County News for Friday, January the 31st, 2020. Can you believe how fast this year is going? I can't. And the first article has the headline, City Aims for HGTV Show. Danville, an approximately 6-minute video highlighting the city's downtown Vermilion Street, upper story residential possibilities, and homes in West Downtown with beautiful architecture, but could use a little more love, is what's being submitted for the city's HGTV contest entry. Danville is among the likely hundreds, if not thousands, of cities across the nation vying to be the chosen town for the next 6-episode HGTV television series to receive a makeover. The application deadline is next week. Earlier this month, HGTV launched a nationwide search to find a town that could use some of the hometown touch. Renovation specialists Ben and Aaron Napier restore old historic homes in their hometown of Laurel, Mississippi on the HGTV Hometown. They also have played a role in helping revitalize their hometown's downtown. Now they are looking to take their show and skills on the road to another town. According to HGTV, they are looking for a town for a whole town overhaul. The new series will be titled Hometown Takeover. The new show's website asks, does your town have a population of less than 40,000? Homes with great architecture longing to be revealed, and a main street that needs a facelift. We want to hear from you. Photos are great, but video is better. Show us a place that you think needs a makeover, i.e. a diner, coffee shop, home, or playground, a tour around town, the places that need help, and the people who love this town, and anywhere your town needs love and what you love about it. Towns can upload photos and a video. Applicants are to highlight specific aspects of their town that make it special, fascinating, historic, or unique, including distinctive features like vintage period architecture, special destinations, and a classic main street. If selected, town citizens can expect the rehab of multiple individual family homes and the revitalization of public spaces, parks, local diners or restaurants, and outdoor recreation areas. I'm pretty happy with it, said Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. about Danville's video submission. The video is being tweaked and finalized and will be submitted to HGTV on Monday. Williams said he knows some towns such as Attica, Indiana, are having big community get-togethers as part of their videos due to the limited time an event wasn't scheduled here. Williams, however, thinks Danville's video is pretty strong. Danville officials had help from Philip Joya with Center Street Productions of Watsika in putting the video together. Joya also helps in the community with the Step Up Group and an annual Global Leadership Summit events at Second Church of Christ. Williams talks at the start of the video about how Danville in the past wouldn't have been eligible for the contest due to its larger population and more robust industries. Now, however, Danville is a great candidate for a town takeover to address some needed residential renovations. Danville School District 118 Superintendent Alicia Geddes talks on the video comparing Danville to a girl who doesn't recognize her prettiness. Community volunteers Mike Hulvey and Deanna Witzel talk about the famous celebrities from Danville and Danville's hometown feel. And Fisher Theater Executive Director Jason Murrow talks about the event space and other potential uses with more renovations above the Fisher Theater. The video has some music in the background and provides various views such as neighborhoods, downtown, and inside the Fisher Theater. We showed all Danville and emphasized downtown and West Danville, Williams said. He said the goal would be to see downtown Vermilion Street storefronts and the Fisher Theater receive more renovation help. He said there continues to be great work taking place across the city, but with renovation help, he thinks would put us over the top. William said the public will be able to see the video soon when it's placed on the city's website at www.cityofdanville.org and on social media. And now, an article with the headline, "I Kind of Died, Salt Fork Nurse Staffs, Staff Others Revive Student." Dateline Catlin. Katie Fritz is a vibrant and articulate Salt Fork High senior who is focused on pursuing a career as a physical therapist for children with prosthetics or orthotics. At just 16 years old, Katie will graduate early and is set to begin her studies in health sciences this summer at the University of South Florida. Eventually, she would like to receive a nursing degree as well. On January 16th, those life plans were more momentarily put on hold after the teen suffered a cardiac arrest the high school cafeteria. Thinking that this happened only 2 weeks ago, it's a miracle, Salt Fork Superintendent Phil Cox said to Katie, "You are a fighter. You fought for your life." The quick thinking of school staff and nearby students, as well as the availability of an automated external defibrillator, AED, in the school saved the teen's life. She was eating lunch when she slumped over, school nurse Jenny Birch said. The kids ran up to cafeteria workers Emily Long and Kami Bell and said Katie was seizing. Katie had fallen down to the floor and the lunch ladies rolled her on her side on the floor, which is protocol for someone having a seizure, Birch said. Another cafeteria worker, Nita Lagotchki, called the main office to report a student was having seizures, prompting Birch to be paged. Birch, I think that's the right pronunciation, it's B-I-R-G-E, who is a registered nurse with a bachelor's degree from Lakeville School of Nursing, immediately recognized that Katie wasn't having a seizure. When I got to her, she had a very faint pulse, she said. I had to rule out whether it was a heart issue or a seizure, and I could tell by how she was breathing and her coloring that it wasn't a seizure. Birch told Katie's sister Olivia to find an adult who could bring her an AED as she started chest compressions. Teacher Brian Russell cleared the students from the cafeteria, and athletic director Jim DePratt called 911. Hearing there was a medical emergency involving a student, Cox made his way to the cafeteria where he was met by Olivia, who relayed to him the need for the AED. Cox grabbed the closest of the four AEDs on the Salt Fork High School campus and proceeded to climb over tables in the cafeteria to reach Birch and Katie. When I rolled her over on her back, she stopped breathing and she had no pulse, Birch said. Jim DePratt was talking to Katie the whole time, telling her to keep fighting. As Cox prepared the AED for use, Birch continued administering 30 compressions and 2 breaths. Once in use, the AED assessed Katie and analyzed her heart rhythm and advised Birch to administer a shock to the teen's heart. Catlin Police Chief Tad Beto arrived on the scene and gave the breaths as Birch continued with the compressions and sternum rubs. After administering a second shock, Katie regained a very faint pulse. A total of 3 shocks were given, and on the fourth time, the AED said no more shocks were advised. By this time, the emergency medical technicians arrived, which included an emergency room doctor on board. Katie had been stabilized. Those who don't know Katie wouldn't suspect that she had suffered a major medical emergency and spent a week at OSF Medical Center in Peoria, where she underwent surgery to install an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, an ICD. The only noticeable difference in Katie is that her left arm is in a sling to protect her from being accidentally bumped. While her chest heals, Katie had been diagnosed with long QT syndrome type 2, a congenital disorder that can cause arrhythmia-related loss of consciousness and sudden death. "I've most likely had it since birth," she said. "It's not acquired, it's hereditary." Electrocardiograms, EKGs, have been ordered for Katie's parents, Jared and Wendy Fritz, and her sister, Olivia. Her parents, Grandma, and Olivia also will undergo genetic testing. Katie has no recollection of her medical emergency. In fact, she has little memory of that day altogether. I don't have any memories of it, she said. I only remember being in my first hour class, and then all I remember after that is waking up at OSF in Peoria. She doesn't remember about 3 hours from her first hour class until lunch, Cox said. Katie said she wishes she could remember parts of that day to understand the magnitude of it. I don't realize how big of a deal it was, she said. Medically, I kind of died. There's only one emotion I have, and that is gratitude for those around me and the quick action of Mrs. Burge, the teen said. The seriousness of what happened is not lost on the team, though. Of the people who have had cardiac arrest, the survival rate is 6% when it occurs outside of a hospital, and only 8% of those walk away without any long-term mental or physical effects, she read from a saved website on her cell phone. Katie's new reality is living with an ICD for the rest of her life. The ICD monitors my heart, and if it notices arrhythmia or if my heart starts beating irregularly, it will give me a shock, she said. Also, she will no longer be able to drink caffeinated beverages such as coffee and pop. So I think it's a fair trade-off, taking it in stride. Not being able to play physical contact sports, however, is a little bit more difficult for her to accept since she was a three-sport athlete at Salt Fork: basketball, cross-country, and track. Katie said she now will make it her goal to raise awareness about long QT syndrome, which is relatively rare with only 200,000 cases reported each year. I want to inform people about the condition, she said. In addition, Cox said training all the staff in the Salt Fork District on how to use an AED has become a priority. Because of this, our entire staff will be trained at our next professional development day, he said. Burge agreed. We should do a mock medical emergency drill like we do fire drills, tornado drills, and active shooter drills. Burge admitted she was extremely worried about Katie when she left the school by ambulance that day. When she left here that Thursday, it didn't look good, she said. I played it back in my head, everything I did, and wondered if I did everything I could. I'm living proof that you did, Katie interjected. If Mrs. Burge wasn't there, I wouldn't be alive. Miracles don't happen without the help of others, she said. Burge said, I look at her and think, wow, I saved her life, but the good Lord was there too. She's going to go on to do great things, she said. And now for the death notices. And the first is for Gladys Diane Sexton Boland, 65, of rural Hillsboro, Indiana, died on Wednesday, January 29th. Cremation will take place. A memorial service will be at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Saturday, February 8th, at Hedrick Church of God, with David Cheatwood officiating. Contributions may be made to PSP, Progressive Supra Nuclear Palsy, or Hedrick Church of Christ. And the next is for Charlene, quote-unquote, Chucky Mae Hickman. Charlene, quote-unquote, Chucky Mae Hickman, 78, of Potomac, died on January 25th, 2020, in Pascagoula, Mississippi. A celebration of Charlene's life will be at 1 p.m. Saturday, February 1st, at Community Church of God in Danville. Visitation will precede the service from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday at the church. She will be laid to rest following the services in Potomac Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Community Church of God Mission Fund. And the next is for Leo J. Milius, 86, of Bismarck, who died on Tuesday, January 28th. A celebration of his life will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, February 1st, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center, 3940 North Vermilion Street, Danville, with Pastor Bruce Thornsboro officiating. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Friday at the funeral home. He will be laid to rest in Walnut Corner Cemetery with military rites conducted by American Legion Post 210 of Danville. Memorial donations may be made in his name to Emmanuel Lutheran Church. And now for the community briefs. And the first is, has the headline, Audition Set. And this one comes from Danbo. DLO Musical Theater will conduct auditions for Mamma Mia at 2 to 5 p.m. Saturday and 5:30 to 8 p.m. Sunday at Center Stage in the Village Mall. Participants should be prepared to sing during the audition. If needed, callbacks will be held Monday. For information, visit DLOMusicalTheater, all one word, .com. And the next has the headline, Museum Plans Event. The Vermilion County Museum Society is celebrating Lincoln's 211th birthday with an open house at 1:30 to 4 p.m. February the 9th in the museum, 116 North Gilbert Street. Lincoln birthday cards created by children in the county and Danville schools will be on display. Both the Museum Center and the Fithian House will be open. There is no admission charge. Parking is available in the museum parking lot, First Midwest Bank lot, and the north end of Big Lots parking lot. For information, call the museum at 217-442-2922 or visit www.vermilioncountymuseum.org. And the next one comes from Fairmount. Beginning beekeeping workshops will be February 1st at the Training Center at Long Lane Honeybee Farms. Learn the basics from David Burns, who is an EAS certified master beekeeper with more than 25 years of experience. A fee is being charged for the class. For information and to sign up, go to honeybeesonline, all one word, .com and call the office at 217-427-2678. And the next is from Westville. The Westville Afternoon at the Movies, presented by the Westville Public Library, will be at 2 p.m. February 1st. The film stars Amy Adams and as Anna Brady, who plans to travel to Dublin, Ireland, to propose marriage to her boyfriend, Jeremy, on Leap Day. Call the library at 267-3170 to reserve a seat. And now an editorial. I don't know, this might be just an information article. And the article has the headline, Illinois sues to add Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Dateline Springfield. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul and two other state attorneys general filed a suit in federal court Thursday to ensure the Equal Rights Amendment officially becomes the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Americans have long agreed that discrimination based on sex is unacceptable, Raoul said. But by enshrining that shared value in our Constitution, we have made a commitment never to go back. The states filing suit, Illinois, Virginia, and Nevada, were the final three states to ratify the ERA. Nevada signed on in 2017, Illinois in 2018, and Virginia 2 weeks ago, allowing the amendment to meet the 38-state threshold to be added to the Constitution. However, making the ERA binding is not as simple. In the complaint, the attorneys general are asking the court to direct U.S. National Archivist David Ferrero to officially write the ERA into the Constitution as per his duty. The U.S. Department of Justice, however, effectively ordered Ferrero not to do so because the ratification deadline imposed by Congress expired in 1979. Additionally, five states want their ratifications rescinded: Idaho, Kentucky, Nebraska, Tennessee, and South Dakota. The latter joined Alabama and Louisiana in a federal lawsuit last month that aims to block Ferrero from adding the ERA to the Constitution. Experts have said it is likely the final decision will have to be made by a court. The three AGs hinge much of their argument on Article 5 of the Constitution, which governs how amendments are ratified. The power to decide when to ratify it is not limited in any way by Article 5, Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring said. Nowhere does it provide for rescission. A proposed constitutional amendment becomes valid once it is, quote, ratified by legislatures of 3/4, close quote, of the states, Article 5 reads. Also, the lawsuit argues the 27th Amendment was added to the Constitution in 1992 by then-archivist Don Wilson shortly after the final state ratified it. As an Illinois state senator in 2018 to ratify the ERA, it was one of my very last acts as a member of the legislature, he said, and to have been elected Attorney General and to be able to contribute to making certain that we recognize the 28th Amendment, it means a lot to me. Raul added that he has a 19-year-old daughter in college who aspires to go to law school. She will promise to support a constitution that will equally support her, he said. A 2016 poll commissioned by the ERA Coalition found 77% of Americans strongly agree with a constitutional amendment that guarantees equal rights to both men and women. Another 17% somewhat agree. We have waited too long already for equal rights, and it is shameful that there are those who would have us wait even a moment longer, said Carol Jenkins, co-president and CEO of the coalition, which is comprised of more than 100 organizations supporting women's equality. Jenkins says securing the ERA is a life or death issue because it will give women a legal basis to take on issues of gender inequality, including pay differences and violent crimes. Women in the home and workplace continue to fear sexual and physical assault with no recourse to federal courts because without the ERA, there is no basis for just such jurisdiction, she said. The Equal Rights Amendment is 24 words long and reads, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. And the next is an editorial that was originally published in the Arlington Heights Daily Herald on January 23rd. And its headline reads, A Different Direction on Ticket Enforcement. It seems logical if you want to collect an unpaid parking ticket or vehicle sticker violations, threaten to revoke driver's licenses of people who don't pay. Chicago Mayor Harold Washington Obama was among those who lobbied in the 1980s for the legislative change to allow license suspensions for ticket debt, seeing it as a way to prod payment and increase revenue, according to ProPublica Illinois. And it worked. More than half those threatened with license suspension paid up or agreed to payment plans. Then the law of unintended consequences came crashing down. It turned out more tickets were issued to people in low and moderate income areas, a Woodstock Institute study showed. It turned out delinquent tickets were considerably more common in those areas. And as ProPublica and WBEZ discovered, it turned out the unpaid tickets sometimes triggered a downward spiral in which low-income drivers risk falling into the criminal justice system by driving on a suspended license or were declaring bankruptcy with mounting ticket debt and fines as their motivation. Both outcomes actually reduce the opportunity for people to go to work, make some money, and pay off the tickets. Given the evidence, we think the legislature and Governor J.B. Pritzker did the right thing in deciding to stop suspending licenses for people with backlogs of tickets for non-moving violations beginning July 1st. About 55,000 people will get their licenses reinstated if they lost driving privileges over unpaid tickets that didn't involve unsafe driving. Without the threat of license suspensions to compel people, won't fine collections fall short? Yes and no. Ticket revenue in some areas will drop to the tune of $15 million in Chicago. But in Cook County, State's Attorney Kim Fox already has stopped prosecuting driver's license suspensions stemming from unpaid tickets, saying her office was spending too much time taking these cases to court. What happens now? Parking tickets will still have to be written in areas where safety is a concern, but late fees should be structured fairly rather than skyrocketing so quickly that they preclude payment. Some suburbs have given up on vehicle stickers as time-consuming and inefficient, but others are stepping up enforcement. In those towns, penalties should be designed with grace periods, reminders, and low initial fines with a goal of getting the stickers on the cars rather than getting maximum funds out of the car owners. And that came from the Arlington Heights Daily Herald on January the 23rd. And now another editorial. This is from Campbell Hill. And, okay, it looks like it was written in Campbell Hill, but it doesn't have a title. It starts with the sentence, "Trico, do you have the worksheet?" Their microphone muted. Students Shaley Swisher and Jasmine Sir silently raise a thumbs up to the webcam before them. The instructor on the big screen monitor, broadcasting from John A. Logan Community College, 35 miles away, nods and begins her Spanish 102 lesson, diagramming sentences with action verbs and direct object pronouns. The virtual classroom can be a challenging place to learn a foreign language, Swisher and Sir agreed. They get few opportunities to practice speaking directly with the teacher and have only each other for help with worksheets. Announcements blare over the school intercom, drowning out the lesson, and brief internet glitches are a frequent frustration. But the class is well worth their time, the young women agree. I really like that we have this opportunity, said Sir, a senior. I've always wanted to take foreign language classes, but we didn't have them, so it was like, I guess I'll have to wait till college. Now I don't have to wait. For years, Trico, a small school in rural northern Jackson County, has struggled to find a qualified Spanish teacher, said Principal Mark Riley. It's a challenge faced at high schools throughout the state, throughout downstate Illinois, where unfilled bilingual and foreign language teaching jobs make up a significant portion of the mounting teacher shortage. This year, for the first time, John A. Logan College is providing Spanish via a video conference to three local high schools without instructors of their own, Trico, Alvarado, and Crab Orchard. With a $50,000 grant from the Illinois Community College Board, the college has provided a webcam and big screen monitor to each of the schools, plus another set for the teacher in a classroom on the college's Carterville campus. The instructor teaches students from all three high schools simultaneously, plus a room full of her own community college students, every morning from 8 to 8:50 a.m. As she moves through the lesson, she looks into the webcam frequently to check in with her high schools, making sure each classroom is keeping up. Students can ask questions or request help through their school's feed at any time, though mostly they keep their microphones silenced to eliminate to limit distracting noise. For much of the class, the screen of Trico shows the instructor at another screen, a high-tech whiteboard that she writes on with a stylus. Sir and Swisher follow the lesson on their worksheets and check vocabulary on their school laptops. Neither appears distracted by the technology humming all around them. I'm comfortable with it, Sir said. Maybe it's just because of my age. Trico announced the opportunity for Spanish dual credit to all its students, Riley said, with a special focus on upperclassmen who have time for electives. We definitely attempted to sell it to our student body as an opportunity for experimental learning, Riley said. The individuals who took advantage tend to be self-motivated people who saw a challenge and went for it. Eight students signed up in the fall. I have used up all my time. I look forward to reading with you again soon. This has been Lois Pausch reading the Vermilion County News for Friday, January the 31st, 2020.